of the introductions. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to day two of Tech Ed. Today we're going to be talking about big data. Sitting in the foundational session yesterday on big data and data warehousing, I noticed that a lot of people raised their hands when they said they hadn't started on big data. What really wasn't quite sure what big data was, so I thought that was a good sign for this talk, because really what we're going to talk about today more than anything is, what is big data according to Brian? Try to demystify it quite a bit by talking to you guys about what some of the sources of big data is, and once you have it, what can you do with it kind of stuff. So there's a lot of theory involved. At the end, if you stay long enough, the last half an hour or so, we'll do some demos using HD Insight. We'll do some Hive and Pig and JavaScript demos, and then walk you through some of the other tools that we have available for big data. So we'll go ahead and get started. So you saw that. My name is Brian Mitchell. I'm from the Microsoft BI and Big Data Center of Expertise out of Microsoft Consulting Services. This mic seems to be going in and out. So this is basically me by the numbers. At the end of the day, what you can see is I have some experience with SQL Server. I have some of the highest certifications with SQL Server. You can see my blogs down there and Twitter information if you want to follow me or read my blog as you want to. And we'll go ahead and get started. What we're going to talk about today is basically talk about big data, some of the sources, and some of the scenarios and how you go about using it. And we'll try to demystify it a little bit as we walk through it. All right, so first of all, I hate the term big data. Probably like a lot of you guys do. I feel like it's somewhat of a marketing term or a buzzword. Really what we're going to be talking about is just data, different sources of data that are coming to you, and how do you deal with them and what do you do with them. So really to kind of couch it in a metaphor, what I like to do is I like this metaphor of, you know, for a long time, man slept under campfires and looked up at the stars, and all he saw was a bunch of white dots. And he would try to make some sense out of them by doing some stuff like creating constellations or whatever, but basically all he saw was white dots. Until this man came along and invented the optical telescope. And once he did that and invented the optical telescope, we were able to see the stars in a much different light. Each one of those white dots brought out a huge amount of detail. Whether or not you're talking about nebulas or red stars or yellow stars or galaxies, there's a lot of detail in there, and it was a complete transformation of how we saw the world. And really when we start talking about new sources of data and big data, we're kind of talking about the same transformation. Let's think about it from a product perspective and just, you know, how stores used to sell product. So you have here like a typical grocery store. And the way it used to be, long before UPC codes and everything else, is people would go to a grocery store and they would get a basket and they'd go around to the shelves and they would pick some items off the shelves, and they may or may not have some little tags on them telling them how much they cost. And then they would take that basket up to the front and they would ring up the items. And then once that customer left, the owner of the grocery store had no idea what they bought, where they bought it, how they shopped, or anything like that. All they knew is that they had a total of $27.32 for a basket of items. And so for them to do their inventory, they would have to walk around their store and mark off on the shelf how many they had of each item, and they would have to do inventory. So they not only had to manage their inventory because they didn't know what the customer bought, but they also didn't know anything about their customer and their customer shopping habits. That's somewhat changed with the UPC code. So once we had UPC codes, as you rang up items, you now know what the customer bought. You can get a semblance of a basket for that customer, and you also know you're running inventory at the same time. So it gave supermarkets, for example, a much better idea of what their customer and their market baskets look like. But it changed quite a bit when the internet came along, right? So the new world order, or the, you know, kind of comparison to the telescope, is the ability to basically track everything a customer does. So you think of Amazon, for example, is the typical example we like to use when we talk about big data. They not only know what items you bought, they know what items you looked at and didn't buy. They know what items that you put into a shopping basket and took out. They know what items you put into a wish list. They know what items people that buy like items like you like to buy. And we all know what Amazon does, because many of us use it fairly regularly. I live kind of out in the sticks in Florida. I use Amazon on a weekly basis. Amazon knows a lot about me. And so they're able to market very effectively to me. Same thing with Bing and Google. They know a lot about you based on every search term that you've ever put into Google, for example, from the year 1999 forward, they have. And everything else that you've done with Google, every link that you've clicked on, they have. And so they have a lot of detail about you to be able to provide lots of recommendations to you, not only about what links they should provide, but also about what kind of items that you might want to buy or what kind of things you might want to shop for. It's a very powerful analysis. So really, that's kind of the metaphor for how the world has changed and how much more data we are collecting. We're not just collecting what items you bought, we're collecting a lot more detail. A different way to look at it is this slide that I like to use. For most of us that have been working with data over the last 20 years, we've mostly stayed in this green space, dealing things with, you know, like ERP and CRM data, sales pipelines and inventory and payrolls and manufacturing kind of stuff. Some of us have been grappling a little bit with Web 2.0 data the last few years and how to try to manage that and try to force that into some sort of relational database. Larger data sizes, a little bit faster data. Some of it's a little more complex. It might be coming in JSON or XML. So we've been trying to deal with some of those e-commerce or web logs, and that's been difficult enough. But then when you start talking about new sorts of data like clickstream analysis and log files and weather data and text data, it's not only more variety, it has more velocity possibly, but it also means that there's probably a lot more data. And when you start trying to think about how you're going to deal with that in a relational method, it becomes a little more daunting. And that's just another way of kind of defining what big data may or may not be. So generally speaking, people tend to define it with the three V's: volume, velocity, and variety. And this is, you know, I could talk to each one of these at some length, but I'd like to talk to it with this kind of slide, which is the kind of the cube, where it shows volume, velocity, and variety on three different axes. And you can see there on variety, you have a difference between a key value pair, which we talk a lot in big data and Hadoop worlds, versus the foreign key, primary keys, on the volume between small and big, and then on velocity, whether or not you're pulling data or pushing data. So generally in SQL Server, if you're doing some relational ETL work, you're usually pulling data. And so what we want to talk about is where does big data exist? Here's where SQL Server's generally traditionally existed, and every other SMP database out there is pretty much in this kind of corner, where we're dealing with foreign key pairs, a relatively small amount of volume, and we're pulling data to it. But what happens when your volume starts increasing? So one of the things, if we start talking about volume, oftentimes we talk about the three V's. Some people say you need two of the three V's to have big data. I really don't care about that, but with volume, for example, you can have more volume, and it's still not down there in that corner where you're talking about a lot of data. There are products that are out there that handle volume pretty well. The fast track reference architectures that we have can deal with rather large size of volumes. PDW, which is our massively parallel appliance, can handle really large sets of volumes into the hundreds of terabytes, if not petabyte ranges. So you can have lots of volume, but if the velocity and variety aren't all that complex, you can usually still handle it with traditional relational database methods. On the other hand, when you start talking about added velocity and added variety, you start talking about the Hadoop world and doing things a little differently. So once you have more variety, we start dealing with key value pairs, and I'll show you a little bit about what that means later. And then also, we can also be talking about pushing data to our system, and usually HD Insight or Hadoop can handle that pretty well. Velocity, oftentimes people kind of talk about velocity being how fast data is coming in. I tend to refer to it as how fast can you respond to data. You can handle a lot of velocity in a relational way, but can you provide reporting or BI or analytics on it pretty fast? There's tools out there, complex event processing tools like Stream Insight from Microsoft, which can provide you the ability to handle velocity in a way that you can give back record sets and BI based on the last few tweets that are coming in, for example, on a stream in flight, for example. And we'll talk a little bit about that. So in my opinion, it's not really the size of the data. It's definitely not tools, even though we show tools to kind of show how to handle it. But really, it's kind of a new paradigm on how to collect and use data differently. And what I mean by that is we have a lot of new sources. Whether or not you're talking about like your Amazon and a retailer, pretty much all your popular websites like Facebook and Amazon and Google and Bing are all big data because they're collecting lots of information about their customers. But if you're a traditional organization that has a traditional set of organizational data, the idea of big data is, what is all the data outside of your traditional relational data that you've been collecting for years that you could incorporate and mesh up with that data in order to be able to get new insights about where you might be able to find some opportunities? And there's lots of good examples like that. Just to start off with an example, one example traditionally has been Walmart a few years ago was looking at the possibility of being able to determine what products people may need to buy when a hurricane was imminent. And so what they did was they took all of their organizational data, that is all their sales data from their stores, and what they needed to do is match that up with weather data. So by matching that data up with weather data from external sources, along with their sales data, they were able to determine that one of the products that people like to buy when a hurricane is imminent, of all things, is Pop-Tarts. Why Pop-Tarts? Well, it actually kind of makes sense if you think about it. It's portable. It comes in that aluminum foil, so it can't get ruined if it gets wet. And if you open up one of those bags and eat both of those, that's like half your calories for the day. So it actually makes a little bit of sense that Pop-Tarts might be. And so they use that information so that when hurricanes are imminent, when you walk into a Walmart, one of the things that may be up front or, is, along with the batteries and flashlights, is Pop-Tarts. And so that's just a small example of, you know, how you can take outside data, mash it up with what you have today, and try to find new insights about what you can possibly get. And notice that wasn't an example of looking backwards. Yeah, they had to use the organizational data, but what they're trying to do is figure out what they need to do next. And that's a theme that you're going to hear from me throughout the day, is talking about big data and eventually predictive analytics, is that all of this is all about what can you do to predict how to make your company better, not to look backwards, because we pretty much have that figured out, and I'll talk at length about that later. This does not want to change. All right, so this is what our traditional BI environments look like, and I set this up so we can look at what it may look like in the later on in the presentation. You know, traditionally we've had a lot of transactional data. We deal with it by basically pushing it through ETL into a data warehouse. And then once we have it in a data warehouse, oftentimes we'll then push it out to an OLAP cube of some sort and then do reporting on there. And one of the things you see is the data is basically landed in multiple places. We're having to use ETL servers to process the data. As data grows, that ETL layer oftentimes becomes a bottleneck for us because we're dealing with a large amount of data, and trying to push that through to a data warehouse can be somewhat problematic. Generally, when you start talking about large sets of data, as I'll show you in the slides later, we tend to like to talk about ELT, which is extract, load, and transform. Transform using the power of parallelism, for example. And you can either use Hadoop to do that in HDInsight, or you can use like a product like PDW in the data warehouse layer to do that. But generally speaking, you know, as your first foray into big data, a lot of times a lot of companies will start with changing their ETL process to ELT and using Hadoop for that ELT process. You may need big data. This is kind of my Jeff Foxworthy thing, if your customers are saying this. So, you know, if they can't force everything into a star schema, you can't get access to all the relevant data, you need external data, you're missing ETL windows. Those kind of things are the things that you may need to do if you may need big data, if these are the kind of things that your customers within your organizations are saying. The type of data that's being generated by sector, this is just giving you an idea of outside of your typical relational data, some of the data by sector that may be being generated, and you may not be dealing with it in your BI and analytics environments yet. But within your sector, these may be opportunities to collect that data and do something with. And we'll talk to each one of these, whether or not it's text and numbers or images or audio later on, and how you might be able to incorporate that into your data and how to take advantage of it. All right, I'm putting down the clicker. Clicker's dead to me. And why big data is important? So my opinion is big data is important because companies tend to be fairly inefficient. They tend to throw away a lot of money at doing certain things. And one of the examples is marketing. If you think about marketing across here in the States and how companies market to people, it's fairly inefficient. You take an example of if you're doing a snail mail marketing campaign and you're mailing out a million flyers, and each one of those flyers basically costs you a dollar to do. So that's a $1 million marketing campaign, and you get back a 5% response rate. And that 5% response rate, you know, maybe helps you make $1.2 million. So you made $200,000, you did a good job. Well, what if you could use analytics on your customers to not mail out a million flyers, but mail out 100,000 flyers and get back a 50% response rate? Now, 100,000 flyers at a dollar a piece, that's $100,000. If you get the same response rate that you got before and you made $1.2 million, you just now made $1.1 million. And that's fairly typical for marketing campaigns. Marketing campaigns are very expensive, and a lot of times they get very little back. So the more efficient you can make them, then the better off you are. So marketing campaigns and using more data is absolutely a way to be more efficient. So how can you get more efficient about your customers? Well, if you have information about your customers in a relational database, what more information can you derive about your customers to find out whether or not they are a potential candidate? There's a lot of external data out there from sources like Twitter, Facebook, and you can go down the list that tell you a lot of information about your customers. If you can incorporate that into your data, then you may be able to have some better information that provides more information about your customers so that you can have a more targeted campaign, and we'll talk a little bit about what that looks like. All right. So let's talk about some of the fundamentals, and this is where we'll spend a good amount of time, is just kind of going through what some of the sources are, and then what you can do with those sources, and then after that we'll go through some demos. All right, so common big data sources. Telematics. So the idea behind telematics is, this is, you know, a mashup of the word telephone and informatics, and the idea is that it's basically a series of events. So an example of this would be, you've all seen the ads from Progressive Insurance about the little thing that you put on your car to keep track of your driving habits. That's a telematics device, right? And what does that do for you as a customer? If you put that on there and you drive really safely, then you could possibly get lower insurance rates. That sounds great for the customers, right? Well, Progressive didn't put it out there because they wanted to be good to their customers. They wanted to be out there because they wanted to improve profits. If they put that device out there and they find out more information about their customers, yeah, they can offer better rates to their good drivers, which is great, but they can also more precisely differentiate their drivers so that they can offer more levels of rates so that they can have more profit per customer. It's a really important aspect that telematics can do so for that particular company. Text files are actually something that's very big in big data. So there's all sorts of text files out there that we have in our organizations that we are not utilizing at all when it comes to our data and analytics environments. So emails, tweets, text messages, documents within your environment, in your SharePoint environments, for example. The idea behind the text files is generally to take something that's unstructured and turn it into something structured. If you were at the demos yesterday during the foundational event, you saw how they turned the unstructured data, it was JSON, so it was semi-structured data, and they turned it into relational data so that you could provide sentiment on it. So that's fairly typical that happens. So, but outside of tweets, you can do all sorts of things. You can do pattern recognition about complaints. So whether or not it's in tweets or Facebook, think about an organization that wants to basically have a better idea of the kind of complaints that customers are making about them out there in the world. Dell has been famous for this by monitoring Twitter for years from the early days and actually responding to customers right on Twitter as needed about particular product defects or complaints that they may have. And it's actually worked out pretty well for them. But think about being able to get a really good idea ahead of time before people start returning items. If they start complaining about them on Twitter or Facebook first, you might know something's actually coming. So monitoring pattern recognition in the social media can be a good place for that. Fraud detection in healthcare is another place that's been identified as a place where you can easily monitor doctor's notes. A lot of healthcare stuff is in open text, and which is then transcribed into doctor's notes and stored in documents. And being able to look for fraud detection of customers or patients is one way that you could do that. And also legal cases. So the ability to be able to monitor email, take all the emails from an organization and churn that through Hadoop to take out the important stuff that you may be looking for a legal case by searching for certain keywords within the email can be a place where you can kind of go through text. Oops. Time and place information. So this is basically GPS information, right? And GPS information is being collected more and more often, all sorts of places. We openly give it to places like Foursquare, Facebook, Twitter, Runkeeper, AT&T, Fitbit. You can go down the list of all sorts of places that are keeping your geospatial information. And that information can be used for all sorts of improvements in items or even social networking. Examples of that are, what if social networks were able to more precisely determine your friends based on social networking? An example is just this room alone. You know, I have lots of friends on Facebook, for example, and it recommends friends to me based on who my friends are. But what if it was able to use geospatial data to, you know, recommend me friends based on events I attend? If you and I are attending the same events on a regular basis, and you know, whether or not we're going to SQL Saturdays or here or you know the local BI users group or what have you, you know, what if they were able to recommend that, you know, us as friends based on that kind of information? I, outside of work, I like to bike. What if it could actually recommend to me who my friends could be based on the kind of people that I interact with on biking? I might not even know their name because I pass them on a regular basis, but because it knows about us a little bit through geospatial space, it could provide better information. Internally, to organizations, there's always that opportunity also. RFID. So today, typically RFID tags are used on pallets in warehouses and for delivery on trucks to like supermarkets, for example. In the future, generally speaking, RFID could possibly be used to be tagged for each little piece of information or item within a grocery store. If you have RFID tags on each item in the grocery store, you can more precisely determine whether or not things like end caps or the front door displays work, because you could determine where people actually picked items up from. There are certain items that when you walk into a grocery store, like around Thanksgiving, that are at the door, and then they're on the end caps, and then they're also in the aisles, and sometimes they're close to the checkout also. And for the supermarket to know where people are picking those things up, they could possibly then know which thing is working and which one is not, and if something's not working, switch it out for another item. And right now, they don't have that kind of detailed information, but that RFID could provide that. And when I give these kind of examples, you know, if you think about them to whatever organization you work with, they're oftentimes can be corollaries to the same thing. Also, reducing fraud. So with RFID tags, a lot of times people steal items, and one of the things they do is they'll buy one item, and then they'll steal copies of the item, and then they'll take one of them back and return it. Well, if an item is actually associated with an RFID tag, then when somebody tries to return something that isn't the exact same item that they bought, that could actually help reduce fraud also. Smart grid information. So today, in the States at least, most electric companies don't have a lot of good information about their customers. Smart grids are starting to be rolled out, and they're really actually fairly important for electric companies, as one example. And the reason for that is, imagine, because basically the way it works today is, you have a meter on your house, and they read it once a month, and you get charged for that. Imagine if your phone company did that. And that is, all they knew was the amount of minutes you used and the amount of data you used. And they wouldn't be able to bill you very smartly. They don't, you know, if the phone company did that, they wouldn't know whether or not you used weekend minutes, night minutes, day minutes, you know, and all that kind of information that they used to use to kind of differentiate you and offer you different tiers of pricing, whether or not you called internally or anything like that. With smart meters, electrical company or utility companies are able to more precisely bill you for when you use your electricity. And those smart meters are generating a lot of data that are coming back to those electric utility companies to use it. Also, we can go on to sensors. So sensors are, typically we talk about the Large Hadron Collider, but really in manufacturing, sensors are being placed everywhere. So within the entire manufacturing process and pretty much every build of things like cars and airplanes, they're putting sensors throughout the entire thing. And what they're doing is they're looking for predictive analytics on when something may deteriorate and fail. And so they're generating a lot of information. So within engines, for example, there's literally hundreds and hundreds of sensors that they're collecting that information, and they're storing it. All that information is going somewhere where they need to store it, generate some analytics so that if something does fail, they can look back on it so that they can possibly provide analytics to watch for that kind of event in the future. Telemetry. I have the Xbox up there because a good example is Xbox. Within gaming, across the industry, they're using a lot of telemetry to basically monitor what you're doing in games. That is, within a game, you do a lot of stuff, and sometimes it's hard and sometimes it's easy. Sometimes it's too hard, and they want to know when it's too hard for people so that they can make it easier. Sometimes it's too easy, and they want to make it harder so that you actually enjoy the game. They're also looking for cheaters in multiplayer games and things like that. And the idea is, I don't know if you've noticed, but whenever you start up your Xbox, if you haven't used it for a week or two, a lot of times those games are being updated. That's because a lot of times they're changing the games to make them so that they're more palatable for the end users. Retail and vending machines. So vending machines use telemetry a lot by being able to provide, send a lot more data back to the home office about inventory and stock so that they can more appropriately keep everything in stock, so that they can make sure that they continue, you know, pushing out product as necessary. Law enforcement is using sensors. So, you know, think of ankle bracelets. And that kind of, there's more and more information being generated from telemetry all the time. And I'll talk a little bit about law enforcement again later. And then finally, social networking. It's more than just Foursquare and Facebook and stuff like that. It's about who you call, who you chat with, who you email with. So think about it as from an organizational standpoint and social networks. Email groupings, and we'll talk about an email example later about who influences who. Internally within your environments, there's all sorts of opportunities to find out who the influences are within your organization or even outside of your organization. Who are the influencers about your product? That's really important to know. And we'll talk about that. So information about social network is important. So an example is when I talk about influencers of your product, imagine I'm somebody that has a contract with a phone company. And, okay, I'm probably not a great example. My wife's probably a better example because she has lots of friends. You know, take my wife, for example. We have a contract with a phone company, and we want to move from one phone company to another. And if they actually look at the kind of phone calls and text messages and how many different people she interacts with, they know that they do not want to lose her. She generates a lot of business for them. And we've had a lot of people move to that phone company so that we could get that inner phone company free calling and everything over the years. And so they know that if they look at the interactions she's had with their customers, they don't want to lose her as a customer. And so that they're going to be able to provide her better offers or us better offers based on that kind of information. So that's a social network. The people that she interacts with on a daily basis are a social network. And I'll have other examples of that and how that from an organizational standpoint, that actually makes sense. Then we're going to talk about some of the algorithms. So I'm going to go through each one of these in other slides. But, you know, basically at the idea is that once you have some of that data, there's things you can do with it. We can find similar items. We can mine some of the data streams. We can do link analysis, deal with frequent item sets, clustering, recommendation systems, mining, and then mining the social network graphs, kind of going back to what we just talked about. And we'll walk through each one of these. So finding similar items. This is kind of the idea behind, there's lots of things you can do with this. Let's take similar web pages. So one of the things you may do is you may have a lot of log information, and you'll want to go out and find similar web pages. Why would you want to do that? Well, there may be people that are plagiarizing your stuff. There may be copies of stuff across your intranet, and you might want to use big data to basically take all the documents and take a look at it and find all the copies of documents and all the similar pages like it so that you can eliminate it and reduce data. Then, you know, articles on the same source. So what I'm talking about here is articles from the same source. So one of the things that things like Bing and Google do when you go to their news pages is lots of times you'll see that there's an article on, I don't know, whatever Justin Bieber did last night. And then there'll be a bunch of links down there below. Well, one of the things they don't want to do is provide a link to the AP article and then five other links from local newspapers all based on the same AP article. They don't want to do that. They want to give you one link to the AP article and then four other links to some other, you know, Justin Bieber stories, for example. And so being able to find the similar web pages and going about doing that is pretty important. And the way you go about doing that is it's all about looking at groupings of text and comparing them and basically finding that, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. And then collaborative filtering. So that's things like online purchases from Amazon or Netflix, being able to compare movie ratings, for example. So mining data streams is another thing that we do quite a bit, which is, data arrives too fast, so you kind of have two choices. You can either, one, summarize it pretty quickly, or you can evaluate a fixed length set of data. So basically, you can either say, give a summary of the data as it's coming in before you store it in your database, or you can basically say, for the last 30 tweets, this is what people were saying about this particular item or something like that. Other data streams, such as images, there's examples of, we have a case study out there if you want to look it up, around the New York Police Department, in which Microsoft and the New York Police Department worked together pretty heavily to provide them with a better system for kind of managing the Manhattan area. And of course, internet and web traffic is a fairly typical example of just the data streams coming in from web traffic and what you do with that. So finding similar items is the, I just did that one, went the wrong way. Market basket analysis. So this is the idea of being able to find frequent item sets, so things that are bought together. And typically the example that you oftentimes hear is the old data mining example of diapers and beer. And the fact that oftentimes when men went out and bought beer at night, they sometimes bought diapers too. But at the end of the day, market basket analysis basically says, when you buy a new laptop on Amazon, you are very likely to buy a new mouse or a new monitor. And those are the kind of things that they're going to, provide you with recommendations on. This also drives those piles of stuff at the supermarket. So market basket analysis drives when you walk into a supermarket and they have that display that changes every week or every couple weeks of things that are bought together. So spaghetti and spaghetti sauce. Seems obvious. Green beans and French fried onions at Thanksgiving time. You could go down the list of all sorts of different things. Chicken and corn on the cob during the summer. So those kind of things, looking at how you can do market basket analysis within your organization to provide better prediction on what your customers might like so you can make it easier for them to buy multiple items at a time. But it doesn't just stop with things like market basket analysis. You can also do things like plagiarism. So it's the same exact concept, except for you're looking, if you take items or the documents and baskets or sentences, and you compare documents to sentences, you can find plagiarism. And there are well-known algorithms within Java and within Hadoop to be able to do that kind of analysis. Related concepts is kind of the same thing. So items are words and baskets are documents. Such as web pages, for example, you can find related web pages. So by looking at web pages internally, you might, and using that kind of well-known algorithm to look for that information, what you can do is go out and find web pages that are basically the same within your organization. And that's a fairly well-known algorithm. Also, you can look internally at your Yammer information, for example, if you guys have Yammer, and look for things like, employees who are more positive about Initiative X may also be, negative about, subject Y. And looking at that kind of information, that kind of market basket analysis. And then finally, we have clustering, which is a fairly straightforward data mining tool, being able to cluster items together. SQL Server and Analysis Services and Excel data mining tools have had this for a while, being able to cluster data together. And then we have recommendation systems, which are fairly typical. So the idea is that the items, being able to provide content-based systems such that you can examine the items that are being recommended. Also, so the idea there is if you watch horror flicks on Netflix, it's going to recommend a scary movie when you get back on there. That's kind of the top 10 for Brian kind of thing. On the other hand, collaborative filtering systems are based on what your friends may like. Basically recommending to you something based on what people like you may like. They may not necessarily be friends, they just may be people like you, and providing the recommendations based on that. So examples of that are, you know, looking at this utility matrix. And this is pretty typical of content-based matrices, which is they're usually fairly sparse. So this is an idea of you have like Lord of the Rings, Big Bang Theory, The Walking Dead, and Twilight. And Twilight's 1 through 3 and what have you, and trying to kind of compare 5 different people and trying to figure out what you may recommend for one person over another. There are well-known algorithms within the Hadoop world that allow you to kind of do this kind of stuff. So the idea is if you look at this, customer A and C are somewhat alike, but you're really basing it on just one recommendation, right? So the idea is, would you recommend anything to customer A based on any of the other 4 people? You may want to recommend to them that they watch The Walking Dead. I don't know. There's really not enough information here to kind of deal with that out. But if you look down a little farther down below, you can tell that A and E are very different. They don't like the same things that they've been recommended. So it's likely that you may recommend Lord of the Rings, for example, to person E based on the fact that they're very different from A. There's usually when we start talking about these kind of utility matrices, you're actually talking about thousands or millions of users and many more items to do the recommendation off of. But it gives you an idea of basically how you kind of sum that up into sparse matrices. How we're able to do that, how can we apply that? So the obvious one is the movie recommendations there. But you can also do that based on products. That's exactly, so the same thing that you do against movies on utility matrices, you can do against products to provide people with those recommendations. But it also can do it for news articles. So the idea is that if people like certain news articles or read certain news articles, then people, if somebody else reads the same news articles, those are news articles you can now provide recommendations to that person. It can go beyond that, though. It can be blogs internally, even, if you have internal blogs on your SharePoint site, for example. There's all sorts of places like that for that kind of stuff. How do you populate it? You can either ask the user. That tends not to work out too well. People tend not to go back and say, yes, I liked something, or no, I didn't. Especially older people within organizations. Younger people may have that habit, like on YouTube, but those of us over the age of 22 don't do it quite as often. So the better, or another way to do it, is the inferences through user behavior. So that is, based on what people click, based on what people touch, you know, just derive all that data. Capture it, store it, keep it. Don't get rid of it, is the idea there. We can also mine social network graphs, and this is actually, there's lots of applications here. So this is an idea of, you have social network graphs, and I'll give a demo of a tool that's available for Excel later that allows you to take a look at graphs, and this could be Facebook, it can be Twitter, it can be an email chain internally to a company, it can be your Yammer groups, there's a lot of different social network graphs out there. And the idea behind it is that it's more than just who are your friends and recommending friends based off that, but it's also what groups you're in. So in this example, if you look at this, D is a person who is just as far away from B as they are from G. But which person do you think that they would actually more likely be friends with? And which person would you recommend to them? Same thing for, and the answer is you would definitely recommend them to be friends with B over being friends with G. Just because they have one, you know, to me that's like, here's my social network graph, there's my in-laws over there in blue, and I happen to be friends with one of them. That doesn't mean I want to be friends with all of them. Where the people on the orange side might be people I actually have things in common with. Hope my in-laws don't listen. Social networks, so obviously we have social networks. We have things like email networks. We have telephone networks are different examples of different social networks. Here's an example of an email network and an actual real example of what a company did to solve a problem. And this is just a graph of email communication amongst different teams working on the same project. So this is a company that had a project going on for months at a time. It was being unsuccessful, and they wanted to know why. They had a theory that their teams were not communicating very well. So what they did was they took just the email information of headers of to and from, and they for the months during the project, they put it all together, and this is what they came up with. And basically what you have is you have different groupings of teams communicating amongst each other quite a bit, but they're in different cities across the world. And what they found was actually if you look between blue and green and red and blue, what you find is they actually don't communicate between each other very much. And the organization was able to use this information to restart the project, reinstitute new inter-team communications, and the project was able to get done on time and on budget after that. And this is actually relatively easy to do. All right, so we're going to go through some demos and kind of show off HD Insight a little bit and kind of make some of this stuff real. And we'll first of all start off with Pig and Hive and Scoop and those kind of things and just kind of show you, because how many people have seen an HD Insight demo at all in the past? Like 3 people. Great. Good. Okay, so I'm going to use HD Insight on Azure. And I have 2 clusters that are set up on Azure already. And I can use either one of them. Both of them are new. I have a USB stick in here. If somebody can tell me why my 2 clusters are called Jayhawk 1988 and Jayhawk 2008. Very good. Come up here afterwards and I'll get you the USB stick. If I had to make one more, it'd be 52. And I'll probably never get the 4th one. All right, so what we're going to do is I built this right before the session started, and basically it's a 4-node cluster. And we're going to come in here and we're going to just click on Manage Cluster, and it's going to click up and bring me to my login page, and I'm going to log into HD Insight. While that's going on, I'll come back here and show you how easy it is to just fire up your own HD Insight cluster. So all you have to do, click on New. It brings you up to HD Insight Preview. You can click on Quick Create. Give it a cluster name. 1952, and I can give it a cluster size. Here's some default sizes that it has in here. If you don't want one of these sizes of either 4, 8, 16, or 32 nodes, you can go to custom create and give it whatever number you want, from 1 to some large number. Because I'm on an MSDN subscription like you guys, I keep it usually pretty small. And then you pick the storage account you've already set up within Azure and create there, and it's going to go off and start creating a 3rd cluster. All right, so let's go back to 1988, and basically you have the choices here, and the first thing I'm going to do is the interactive console. And there's a couple choices here. I either can do things in JavaScript, which I'll do some things in JavaScript, and I can also do things in Hive. Hive is probably the one tool that people new to Hadoop and HD Insight can learn if you're coming from a SQL background, because it is basically a data warehousing query language, just pretty close to SQL. So I'll demo Hive quite a bit just to kind of show you what you can do in it. But the idea behind Hadoop is that we're basically just dealing with text files. And what we're going to do is Hive is something that just allows us to put metadata over the text files so that we can deal with them in a SQL-like language. So to kind of show off what those text files look like, I can use a tool called Cloud Explorer, which is just basically like Windows Explorer, but for Windows Azure, to allow me to see my containers up in the cloud. So this is my storage container up in the cloud, and you can see I have some folders. Every time I create a new HD Insight cluster, because it's pointed at this particular container, what it will do is it will create a new folder, and if I refresh, it's not there yet, but eventually we'll have a Jayhawk 1952 there. But what you can also do is have persistent data. So you can create new containers, and in this example I have a container for airline data. And in this particular container you can see that I have airline data from basically every flight in America from 1987 to 2008. And it kind of gets bigger over time, as you can see. And you can also tell that it's in CSV format, but it's also zipped up. And one of the cool things about Hadoop and HD Insight is you can deal with zipped files and still provide metadata over that, and it just reads them natively. It unzips them as it pulls them into HD Insight. So you can leave things zipped up so it takes less space on disk. And so we could create a table over this. I also have the same set of files in folder format, where I've created a new folder. And so think of this if you're using something like HD Insight in the future and you want to load the data. You may be doing something where you're creating folders for each day, for each week, for each month. In this particular aspect, I just have one for each year. And you just continue loading data over time, and this is how we partition data in HD Insight. And I'll show an example of how we go about doing that. All right, so you've seen how this kind of looks here. If we go back to this page, let's go ahead and start doing things like LS. So Hadoop comes from a Java and Linux world. So a lot of the commands that we use look a lot like those kind of standard Unix commands. And that's just the way it is. So this is an example of, I just created a brand new cluster, and we can see that I really don't have much of anything in here yet. What I'm going to do is kind of just go back and forth so I don't have to type, is I can do the same ls command, but instead of looking at my default container, I can now point it at a particular container, which is that airline data folder at my storage space, which is brianwmitchell.blob.core.windows.net. And once we do that, we can see the exact same files that we saw when I looked inside of Cloud Explorer. So my Hadoop environment has access to that. If we want to take it a step farther, we can take a look at a different folder, which is the airline data folders. Great. And we'll see that we have a bunch of different folders there. I can also clear the screen with CLS, and that just takes me right back up to the top. Can you guys see that in the back okay, or do I need to use Zoom It? You okay? Okay. All right, so what we're going to do next is we're going to create a database, and it looks just like SQL Server. So we'll create a database in Hive by going back here, and we're going to go from JavaScript over to the Hive panel. And the Hive panel essentially looks like this, where we can see the tables within our databases or columns. I tend not to use that up front. We can also just go right down here and do a control V, and we're just going to do a create database. One of the things that you need to know right away about HD Insight and Hadoop in general is it's not a replacement for your data warehouse. And the reason why is because it's not near as fast. It is built to handle large amounts of data. So it is not built to handle trivial amounts of data or really simple things very fast. So a lot of times you're going to see me vamping while it does things. You're going like, create database. That shouldn't take very long, especially when you consider that it's really not, you know, carving up any space or anything. It's just metadata. So everything takes a little bit of time in Hadoop. The cool thing about it is when you start talking about hundreds of terabytes or dozens of terabytes of data, as long as you scale out, you can handle that without any real problems. So we've created a database, and what we're going to do next is we're going to create a table called OnTime External within that database, and it's going to be over the airline data that I had before that I have in that folder. And we'll look at this a little more closely once we get it running. So we'll go ahead and just paste that in there, and we'll let it run. And while that's running, I'll come back and show you again a little more detail what's going on here. So what I'm doing is I'm creating a table, which is essentially metadata, over those folders. And basically what it looks like is this, is that I'm just creating it, and I'm using just some basic data types in it, and then pointing it, once I create that metadata, saying the row format is delimited files terminated by the comma, and the location is that airline data folder within my storage space. If you want to look at what that data looks like, actually, if we want to look at one of those files, one of those CSV files, essentially just looks like this. So the question you might have is, well, why not just load this in SQL Server? And if it's in CSV format or something like that, that's a reasonable question for some data like this. But you may be talking about web logs, where you're talking about terabytes of web logs every day that are coming in. And what you want to do is, oftentimes, you want a data warehouse to provide some sort of functioning BI system on top of it to be able to, you know, kind of identify what's going on from your web logs. But the reality is you're loading those web logs into relational data so that you can churn it through ETL so that you can get a subset of the data stored in your data warehouse. Well, what about storing all those web logs, for example, or any other large set of data in Hadoop, do the churning through there and come up with your aggregated set that you actually want to store in your data warehouse and that defined set that you actually want to drive your BI environment, and then move that to your data warehouse and drive it from there. That way you're not taking a lot of expensive I.O. and disks and data warehousing time doing all that kind of stuff. You leave it to something that is much cheaper, much less expensive on the HD Insight side to be able to do. So if we go back and look, that table should be created easily. And sure enough, it was. So now we can query the table. So going back to, going back to here, we can go back to the demo, and we can show the table really quickly if we want. That shouldn't take too long. And then after that, we can do something like select count from the table. So there's my show tables. I now have one table in there called on-time external. And we're going to go ahead and do a select count from the entire table. So this is going to take a couple minutes to run. And what it's actually doing is my data lives out in Azure Blob Storage. And I have an HD Insight cluster that is in the same data center. And what we need to do is, in parallel, go out and get all those files in my blob storage that are sitting out there and pull them across to the HD Insight clusters and the nodes in there, and then do some MapReduce on it. And that's what it's going to do. It's going to run map jobs to do the counts locally for each one of those files. And then once it's completed those, it's going to reduce the files in another job, which is going to count all the counts. And we can go ahead and look at that by going back to here. And for JHawk 1988, we can go to connect to it and click OK. And that's going to bring up my remote desktop connection. This allows me to log into the head node of the cluster. And on the head node of the cluster, we have some monitoring information, which allows you to watch the jobs as they're running. And conveniently, it's right there on the desktop. So we go to Hadoop administration, and we can see that we have jobs done already. Failed. No matter how many times you practice a demo, there's always the chance. I have no idea why it failed. Kick it off one more time and see if it runs. Not a file, ASV airline data. These plopped in here, and I noticed these when I first started talking. Those should not be in my file, in my folder. I think it's trying to read those. We'll run it one more time. I'm not sure where those files came from an earlier run at the demo. I've been up for a while actually running these over and over again. Probably would have been better off just running them once. All right, so come back in here. Let's see if we have any jobs running. Not yet. Still running, so that's a good sign. So I think I fixed it. It's just going to take a second. If we can go back, there's a couple ways to monitor it. We can go to the panel within Windows Azure and click on the actual nodes that we're working on, and we can take a look at it here. And this gives us some information about how many cores we're running and how many jobs may or may not be running at any given time. We can go into the monitor page, and it gives us some more detail about the jobs, and we can take a look at it over relative or absolute time, or how many hours going back. This is still running, so that's actually a good sign. So if I go back to my head node, here we go. We just have we have 16 running map tasks now, and we're off and running. So got that fixed. And we can drill down here, and we can see our running jobs, and we can actually click into the jobs and see what's going on. So right now we have 22 map tasks running, and that's because we had 22 files. So we got one map task for each file. And once that's complete, you can see that we have one reduced job. So what that means is we're going to go get the count out of each file, and then we'll have 22 counts, and then we'll run that through a reduced job. And you can see 6 of them are pending, 16 of them are running, and I can refresh this at any time. I can see 14 of them have completed now, 8 of them are still running, and it'll complete in just a minute or two. But you can always drill into what's going on in your jobs by coming in here and looking as necessary, and we can come back here. And so what this is going to do is it's going to give us the count, and it's just like SQL Server. It just takes a little bit longer than what you would expect. One of the reasons for that is because I'm doing a select count over all the data. And so that takes a while to do all those map jobs. The other thing is that you notice that this is on the on-time external table, which was just a folder of all the data in one folder like this. So every time I query this particular table, I'm going to query all the data. There is no such thing as indexes or partitioning in this particular example because I created the table this way. So it's always going to be a scan of all the data every time I run it. And there we go back, and we can see that we had like 123 million rows. So I would like to improve that a little bit. That took 166 seconds. And one way to do that is we can create, and if for an example is, if I wanted to query the same exact data but with the year is equals 2008, it'll take just as long to run because there is no index or anything on the year column, for example. And so one of the ways to combat that is to deal with partitioning. So that is to create an on-time partition table within Hive, and it's going to be partitioned down here by year date with the same row format and everything. You'll notice that when I create this table, I haven't given any location information yet. So the first thing you do is you just go ahead and create the table, and that'll take just a few seconds. And while that's creating, I'll bring you down here and show you. I could do a select count of it and get back zero because there's no data in it yet. But what we want to do is we actually want to add the partitions. So when we alter the table, what we do is we add a partition and we provide the year date for it when we add the partition. So in this example, I'm going to provide the year date of 2008 and tell it where the 2008 data actually lives. So it's kind of backwards the way we do it in SQL Server, in that after the data is already on disk, we go ahead and tell it where it lives. So in this case, my table should be created. I can now go in here and alter the table and add that partition. And while that's doing that, I'm going to go ahead and show you that I could go ahead and add a bunch of partitions at the same time if I wanted to, too, and that would be successful. So what would happen here now is once that's done, that's completed, I can copy that and add all these other partitions. And then once that's completed, what I can do is I can go down and I can do a select count from on-time partition where year date equals 2008. And it's only going to create one MapReduce job that points at that one folder that has the 2008 data. Because if you remember, I created a completely separate set of data called airline data folders, and the 2008 data is down here under this folder, and there's only one file there. There could be hundreds of files. It doesn't have to just be one file. But the idea is that when I do a select from just for the year 2008, I'm just going to look at that folder and read any files in that folder and bring that back in Hive. And so that's kind of how we do partitioning and how we limit the data down in HD Insight to improve performance. What I'm going to do, though, is kind of talk about how do we deal with that with SQL Server, and how do we kind of manage BI from this perspective? Well, think of it as if you had all of that data, and you actually wanted to get a subset to do some analysis on. So maybe you're really interested in delays within the Atlanta airport. I live in Tampa. I fly through Atlanta every week, just about. And so what I really want to know is I want to know a lot of information about the Atlanta airport. I can go ahead and create a table within Hive called on-time ATL, for example, and I'm going to query out data from the just the Atlanta airport stuff. And why I would do that, I'm going to just go ahead and get rid of these other partitions because we're running out of time. And what I'm doing here is I'm doing the create table on-time Atlanta as a select from this other table and limiting it down. And really, it could be a join to multiple tables. You could be doing all sorts of crazy analysis here, but the idea is to create an intermediate data set of data that you didn't want to pull into your data warehouse. So this could be terabytes of data, but you really only want to drive gigabytes of data within your BI environment. This is kind of how you go about doing that. So you create this table, and then we can pull it into either Excel or pull it into SQL Server. So that's going to run for a little bit. While that's running, though, one of the things I can show you is how do we move data back and forth from SQL Server to to Hadoop or HD Insight, or move data from HD Insight to SQL Server. We use a tool called Scoop, and Scoop is really effective at moving data back and forth between relational databases and HD Insight and Hadoop. And so basically, Scoop is just the idea is that you have a connection string there. You point it at your SQL Server, you give it its information, you tell it what table you want to pull in, for example. In this particular case, I'm importing into HD Insight, so I'm importing a table from SQL Server into HD Insight, and I'm pointing it at a particular target directory. And the idea is, I may have data in my relational data warehouse that I want to pull into my Hadoop environment for additional analysis, and I would do that by going to the head node and firing up my Hadoop command line. And going to the Scoop folder, and it's bin, and then I can run this command. And basically what it's going to do is it's going to pull that data out of that SQL Server and into Hadoop. I could do the exact same thing if I had that folder, like that on-time ATL file. Once it's created, I could do an export command of that on-time ATL file and point it at SQL Server and pull it into it with the same kind of command. You can use SSIS if you want. Scoop is really efficient at doing this, though. You'll see that it's basically creating a map job, so it's going to do a map job of that table, and then it's going to pull it into SQL Server for me, or pull it out of SQL Server into Hadoop in that particular example. And then there's some other syntax and all sorts of other things you can do with Hive, and that'll give you some ideas. All right, so that's Hive. We also have the JavaScript console so that we can, and it's fairly new to Hadoop. So Hadoop has traditionally been a Java world, and what Microsoft has done through HD Insight is introduce JavaScript for developers so that they can run MapReduce jobs in JavaScript as opposed to having to learn a full-fledged programming language like Hive. So I'm going to show just a demo example of how to go about doing that. And we'll go back to the beginning here. We'll go back to the console and look at that. So in that particular case, what we're going to do is go back to the JavaScript console. And in JavaScript, you saw me earlier, I did an LS. One thing you can always do is you can always do help. Which gives you all the commands that you may need to use from the JavaScript console. So what I'm going to do is, basically, we're going to run this lettercount.js file. And what it is you can see it right here, is there's three default text files from books within HD Insight. And a lot of times people run a word count as like a demo. And I thought I'd make it a little different by just changing the JavaScript a little bit so that we're doing a letter count. Basically, what I want is the first letter of every word in each one of these books so I can find the most popular letter within the books. It could be 1,000 books or 100,000 books. For purposes sake, so we can get it done here, I'm doing three books. So the JavaScript here is we're always taking in a key-value pair. We're going to pull in a key, and we're going to create a value. And basically, in this particular context, the key is going to be the words that come in, and it's going to be letters coming out, and the value is going to be the number 1, which you can see down there at the bottom where I do 2 lowercase, comma 1. That's the value coming out that we're going to pass to the reduce phase, where we get the reduce of the letters and values, where it then sums them all up. It's a very straightforward JavaScript. So how you do that with HDInsight is you write your JavaScript, you write your MapReduce, and then what you do is you can upload it into HDInsight. And what that allows us to do is it brings an upload file, which allows us to go find that file and upload it very quickly. And then once we have it uploaded, we can, if you want, we can go back and look at it. And you'll see that it's been uploaded into the file as lettercount.js. Also, you can see that airports file that I was importing from SQL Server has arrived. So the scoop is done, and it arrived, so I now have a new folder there with that file. But we need to move on due to time constraints. We could cat would allow us to look at the file if we wanted to. We can certainly clear the screen so that we can run the MapReduce job now. So what I'm going to do is, what we're doing is we're actually running pig, passing it the JavaScript. And what we're doing here is, if you look at this, we're saying pig from, and we're telling it where the books lie. So here's the location of the books. And we're passing it this MapReduce file. And then the key value pair is letter and the count of long, or the count. And then once we're done, we want to order it by count descending. We only want the top 24, of course. And we want to put it to a file called DaVinci Top Letters. Called DaVinci Top Letters because one of the books was a DaVinci book. And go ahead and run that. And that's going to take a little bit to run. When it starts up, it gives us a log. So pig's a little different than Hive in that it is running actual MapReduce. It's a completely different syntax than you're used to from a SQL environment, but it allows you to do a lot of those things that I talked about during the first half an hour of the talk, of, you know, those kind of key value pair things of, you know, look, finding similar data sets, finding similar items. There's all sorts of, if you look out there, there's all sorts of algorithms out there to kind of do those jobs. As this is running, we can go over here and we can click on View Log. That'll open up a new page, and we can see that it's kicked off, and it's now running the MapReduce jobs, and I can kind of follow along what's going on there as it's now loaded the data and it's kicking off the MapReduce job. And we actually want this complete because there's some pretty neat things that we can do with it once it's completed in this environment. So what this little web page is not the robust environment that you would do your enterprise, you know, HDInsight kind of things on. What it is great, though, for is the people that have access to the data to kind of mock up some data and get an idea of the kind of data that's in your HDInsight environment before you operationalize it. And this is a really good view of where they can kind of come in and do that and actually allow themselves to create graphs and what have you right in this environment before you operationalize it into a BI environment. If we follow this along, we can see that it's still churning along. And then once that's done, we're going to read that into a file, where we're going to read the file in so that we can take a look at it. Does anybody have any questions while this is running? We've got a minute or two. I can take a question or two. So that's a good question. So the question is it persistent? It can be. If you're going to keep your HDInsight cluster up, it can be. There's also some persistent metadata that you can store it in. In this particular example, if I destroy this cluster, it's going to disappear, and I'd have to recreate it every time I create it. But there are metadata stores for Hive in which you can have a separate metadata store in SQL Server or other relational databases where you can store all that metadata instead of directly within your HDInsight cluster. Another question? I can't see, so just speak up. Uh, So when would I choose partitioning over just making a table over all the data? Probably almost always partition, to be honest. Oh. So the question is, when I did this query, here? Right, so I'm just getting probably what I would consider a intermediate table, a temporary table for analysis. I probably wouldn't worry about partitioning or anything like that. If it's a fairly small subset of data, I just want to pull it in, and then maybe it's just a temporary table that I'm going to push right into SQL Server afterwards. I don't want to persist it because the background data may change, and so I'd probably just go ahead and create it, pull it into SQL or do my analysis on it, and then let it disappear. Either by explicitly deleting it or shutting down the cluster when it came time. So let's go back to the JavaScript stuff. It should be really close to done now. If we go ahead and look at the logs, it says success, so we should be done. All right, so what that allows us to do is, coming back here, is to load that file in, and you can see that the most popular letter is T, the second most popular letter is A. And while that's not very pretty, we like to do things in graphs, right? We can go ahead and take a look at this by going back to the right demo, pulling that data into a graph, and we're going to parse it into JSON so that we can then graph it as a bar chart. So graph.bar data, and we can graph that out. So just in an interactive, way, people can, take a look at this. This isn't what you would actually push out to your end users, but there would be some users that would be able to do the analysis on here to kind of figure out whether or not it's actually something interesting before you go ahead and operationalize it. If you wanted to see it in a pie chart, God knows why, but there you go, you got a pie chart. And then, of course, you can go ahead and, look at the global variables that you may have already. And that's going to list all the variables that you have existing. There's lots of features and functionalities here in the JavaScript console that allow you to do that stuff. So that's a quick look at the HD Insights stuff, both from a Hive and JavaScript, to kind of whet your appetite. There's multiple sessions later on in the week on both of those if you want some more detail. I'm going to go back to here. Really quickly, not going through the demos for these, but R is actually a fairly popular programming language for working with decent data sets, mostly because it allows you to effectively handle data such that you can do things on arrays of data and matrices of data that you cannot normally do with traditional programming languages and traditional structures in SQL. You'll find that a lot of your end users who want to do analytics know R pretty well. A lot of kids coming out of college that are doing analytics today know R pretty well. So they're going to want, you may hear people coming up and asking you about R. It's an open source platform that allows people to do some really cool analytics on numbers. It allows them to do some really quick graphing. It's all in memory. And there is, the talk that I'm going to have here is basically there is ODBC connections for SQL Server for R. You just load them into R and allows people to connect to SQL Server, load the data into R, and do some graphing capabilities there. So it's something that you should be on your radar to know that I'm seeing a lot of people talking about R today. Social network analysis. There is an add-in for Excel on CodePlex called NodeXL that allows you to do social network analysis. A quick demo of that would be such that if I come in here to NodeXL, you can simply do something like just try to find out whether or not you actually want to know more about some social graphing before you try to operationalize it. And something you can do is you can come here and import. And you can do things like import from any PageX file, for example, which is basically the social networking standard file out there. So you can bring in any kind of file like that. But you can also go out and do a Twitter search network such that we can do something like TechEd. Let's see, it's MS TechEd, right? and get the last 1,000 tweets for TechEd and get an idea of who are the influencers this morning around the topic MS TechEd. And this could be anything. It could be any of your products. It could be your company. And what it's going to go out and do, and it's going to go out and query Twitter, bring back all the data, and then allow you to show the graph. And I don't have a lot of time to show you a lot of the features and functionalities. What we can do, though, is we can change the colors. We can actually introduce the pictures from Twitter, the Twitter images for people into these so that we can actually take a better look. But basically what it shows is usually most people that tweet, nobody retweets them, right? It's just a tweet that just goes out there and just kind of their followers follow it and it just kind of dies. But there's going to be certain people here in the middle as you click on them where you can see their connections as people retweet what they do or reply to what they do. And so these are, you know, when we talk about, you know, influencers, it's the people that tend to be here in the middle. And this is actually a really easy way to be able to just, you know, right here in Excel in a tool that you already know, you know, find out who some of those influencers may or may not be. And you know, figure out whether or not there's something interesting in the data that you want to take a look at, so you may want to, so you can operationalize it in more of a big data way. And there's the link within the notes to the CodePlex for it. And it's a really cool tool to use. There's the demo for that. So let me finish up with this. All of this, everything that we talk about, is predictive analytics. And the reason why this is important is because mostly what we've spent the last 10 years as BI people doing is figuring out how to remember really well. Whether or not it's in our business to figure out how many widgets we built or how many widgets we sold or how much money we made, all we've been doing for the last 10 years, generally speaking in BI, is this. And really, when we talk about big data and we talk about what's coming for big data, it's really more about an analytics maturity. Going away or going forward from where we are today, which is performance analytics, which is what happened yesterday, to predictive analytics, trying to figure out what we can do tomorrow to better our interactions with our customers. To finally, maybe someday, prescriptive analytics, which is closing the loop, just allowing the electronics to actually handle how we respond to customer needs and kind of removing the people out of that system. So, in, you know, big data analytics and big data solutions really drives that analytics solutions maturity. So, you saw this slide earlier with the traditional data warehouse and BI environment. What it may look like tomorrow is more like this. You still have your traditional environment. That doesn't really change all that much. But what we have is we have all these new data sources. We have tools like HD Insight, Stream Insight, Hadoop, to be able to, you know, handle the amount of data and the speed in which they come in. And really it's about merging those two data sets together. That's really what it comes down to, is merging that corporate data, that organizational data, with those other new data sources. That's all big data is. And when you do that, you will get new insights about your customers for your organization. If you want some related sessions, here's some related sessions on predictive analytics with Microsoft Big Data, enriching big data for analysis, and then data management in Microsoft HD Insight. Those are some heavy hitters and some big presenters coming up talking more about big data and what it can do for you. So I would definitely recommend hitting those sessions either later today or on Thursday. All right. I'm overdue. I'll take questions down here in front of the stage. I really appreciate your patience. Thank you, everybody.